Princeton College in Iowa. He's going to be commenting on interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2. Put this on.
Okay. Well, I am a brand new ASA member, one of those people that was described earlier who finally heard of the organization through Howard Van Til in April. And I learned of the meeting after the call for papers had gone out. So I'm very, I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you, and I feel very privileged to be able to present these ideas to you for some, hopefully some feedback. My topic is the literal but scientifically plausible interpretations of Genesis 1. I think I'll restrict myself at this point. And if I might have the lights clicked off there, please. And let's see, this goes on like so, I think. Let's see, perhaps that is close to focus. I don't know how many of you have read this book, a 1982 book by Philip Kitcher. He makes the statement that the scientific evidence tells decisively against the literal truth of Genesis. A rather arrogant statement in some ways, but we have to remember this broadside was aimed at the quick creationists led by Henry Morris in an attempt to discredit them. However, the argument is really, that statement is a two-edged sword, because Henry Morris and other young earthers turn Kitcher's statement around. They just flip it over and say that since their interpretation of Genesis must be true, then the scientists are wrong in their interpretation of the evidence. Well, many Christians, including several of my students and members of my own denomination, buy into this polarization, you might say, that either science or Genesis is wrong. And given that simplistic choice, sincere Christians often reject science. After all, the imagery that we're all familiar with of creation by fiat is familiar and appealing. And that choice may be unfortunate that they reject science, but God presumably has eternity to re-educate them as necessary. But what really troubles me is this. When nominal but uncommitted Christians and non-Christians accept the scientific evidence, they often decide that Genesis is wrong and that the rest of the Bible is also therefore suspect. Now, I'm familiar with this attitude, probably many of you are too, because it infected me when I was in high school. Well, in this paper, I will attempt to show you that the scientific story of origins presently emerging does conform to a literal interpretation of Genesis 1. And in doing so, I hope I don't bend either Genesis or science too far out of shape, to use Walt Hearn's. So please bear with me as I progress along this journey. I will also point out an instance in which the quick creationists depart from a literal interpretation. Now, in my teaching on this topic, I do stress the interpretation of Conrad Hayers and Charlie Hummel and Howard Van Til and others, that the main intention of the author of Genesis 1 was not scientific chronology, but really to debunk the pagan gods of sun, moon, earth, and other planets. And I also point out that the sequence of creative days does provide a nice sequence, I mean a symmetrical literary framework for correcting the without form condition and the void condition. And once these insights are pointed out, I find my students say, yeah, that's neat. But Genesis must also be scientifically plausible, they say, if it is divinely inspired. They say, God can do better than just that. They believe that God wouldn't sanction a story that was convincing to a bunch of ancient Hebrews, but was not in agreement with the reality that we perceive in today's science. And I'm also sympathetic with this viewpoint because I share it, and perhaps some of you do too. So let's get into literal interpretations. I'm going to describe here six interpretations, six hypotheses. I'm a scientist. Hypotheses is what I deal with, of verses in Genesis 1, which are both literal and scientifically plausible. Let's take one that's got a perhaps following here in the ASA, the Revelation Day interpretation of the creative days in Genesis 1. I know you're mostly familiar with this. I just want to trace out in very brief detail some of its steps. This is the idea that God revealed to the author, Moses, seven visions or dreams of the progressive sequence of creation during seven successive days or nights. This interpretation was made by William Wister in the 1600s, I understand, from my friend Dallas Kane, and it was made more forcefully by Walter Maunder in the early 1900s, writing for the Victoria Institute. Now, in other words, according to this view, each of the 7 days of creation provides us with a glimpse of some aspect of creation at a given time in the developmental process of the world. Each day in which the information is revealed is certainly a 24-hour day. I mean, after all, this was, if it was Moses' time, there were 24-hour days. And the various glimpses are in a progressive sequence, but the duration of time between glimpses varies considerably. Now, the most persuasive argument in favor of this interpretation is that nobody was looking over God's shoulder watching this process, yet Genesis 1 is written third person by some person describing what God did. It isn't first person, you know, I did this and so on, except where the person quotes God as saying that he did this. Obviously, the information must have been revealed by God to that person. Now, this particular interpretation has been around a long time. The next one has not been made before, to my knowledge, yet it is the only literal interpretation I've heard for day two. And so we get to number two, hypothesis number two. The waters above the firmament in Genesis 1:7 refer to what we now call the Oort cloud of comets. Now, bear with me a minute. I know you know, what is he getting at? Let me spin this out for you. The existence of this outer boundary of our solar system was postulated several years ago by the astronomer Oort, but the dirty snowball theory of comets was only recently confirmed with Halley's Comet, as you all remember. Now, astronomers estimate that there is far more water amongst the comet cloud, than there is on the Earth, which most everybody agrees has the water below the firmament or the expanse. This slide shows an artist's rendition of the Oort cloud surrounding the solar system at the outer limits of the solar system, and it appears in Carl Sagan's new book, Comet. Now, occasionally, comets are nudged out of this region and come careening in toward the big city lights. And recently, a University of Iowa physicist proposed a radical theory last April, as a matter of fact, that Earth's oceans were filled by ice comets. I have a write-up of this theory if anybody is interested. In any case, Earth's oceans and freshwater certainly represent the waters under the firmament. But by this interpretation, the sun, moon, and planets are in the firmament between the two waters as specified in Genesis 1:17. Now, the interpretation of the quick creationists, particularly as expressed in this book by Slusher, is that the waters above were a pre-flood vapor canopy of high clouds that rained on the earth during Noah's flood. And I'll point out that this is obviously not literal, since the sun, moon, and planets would be beyond those waters and not certainly in the firmament as they are in my own particular interpretation. Now next, number three, the earth brings forth grasses and fruit trees whose seed are in themselves as fruit. And on this third day, we are given a glimpse into what we, moderns of today, recognize as the recent or Cenozoic era. For grasses first appear in the Eocene, though flowering trees appeared somewhat earlier. Another clue tells us, moderns, that this third day view onto the developing Earth does take place in the Eocene, but not later. No mention is made at this point of the sun, moon, and other celestial bodies, so that many people infer that a complete cloud cover obscured them from our Earth-bound position, as we are examining the grasses and trees, and the other essentially modern and still living groups of plants that are present by that particular time in the development. We can infer this cloud cover because of what we now know of the climate in Eocene times. Now, oops, did my light go out? Here we go. The Cretaceous and the Eocene were the last times of very warm temperatures that were global, pole to pole. The warmer than normal temperatures are on this side, and you can see all through the age of dinosaurs, very warm, extending right up to the end of the Eocene, and then a rapid drop to our current situation. In the Eocene, subtropical plants flourished in the Arctic. The Cretaceous is well known for its warmth, which allowed the age of dinosaurs. It's now also a well-known story how that warmth ended, as told by Walter Alvarez. You're all familiar with this impact of the large comet or asteroid producing a global cooling and the subsequent end to the age of dinosaurs as green plants folded up shop, except for their seeds, of course, which the mammals were still able to nibble at. Now, how do we get that warm climate? Modelers in meteorology and climate have been at work on this problem for some 8 to 10 years, and the models that have been developed to simulate such a globally hot climate require a high and complete cloud cover with a fairly pronounced greenhouse effect, both conditions required. Otherwise, they simply can't get that global warmth that we observe in the fossil record. Well, let's move on to day four. Number four here gives us a glimpse of the clear skies so that the sun, moon, and other heavenly bodies can now be seen by our earthbound observer as they can today. We of today now know that this glimpse is at or after the end of the Eocene because that is when the cloud cover of the warm era broke up. Current explanation for that breakup is that a comet or asteroid that struck southern Florida at that time, took the end of the Eocene, making the Florida, whoops, I'm sorry here, let me go one more, making this Florida bowl there, is the one that the big smack that apparently caused the end of the Eocene climate and then the end of the Eocene era. Now, this is very important for us to note because Henry Morris's argument in his Scientific Creationist for a young Earth really hangs on the sun being created on the fourth day. He says that the plants of the third day can hang out for a day without sunshine, but not for an age. And you've all heard that, I'm sure, by the interpretation I'm forwarding here, which is a modification of an older theory. The sun and other celestial objects were there. They'd been there for some time. But they had been obscured by clouds during the previous few glimpses that we had been given in the Genesis Revelation days. Well, day five is a view of what we can recognize as late Cenozoic times. The still living creatures of the land and the sea and the air have developed. There is no reference here to extinct forms of life, as that would have been meaningless to the ancient Hebrew reader. Day six is a view of what we now recognize as really late Cenozoic times and what we refer to as the Pleistocene epoch. Here we view people created in the image of God, as it says on day six. And this is an indication to me that we are seeing members of our own species, Homo sapiens sapiens, who are fully capable of speech. The Bible tells us that the Word was God and was with God and is God, and so the capability of making words with combinations of vowels and consonants is a vital aspect of our being human. Most anthropologists are now zeroing in on this as the distinctive human trait. Recent studies by Ed Creelan at Yale University and Philip Lieberman at Connecticut have shown that only humans have a two-tube resonating chamber. We have a pharynx here and a mouth above the voice box. And we can modify both independently. To make our vowels, we modify the pharynx. To make our consonants, it's mostly up here. We are the only animal that can do that. Not even our closest relatives can do that. They can make one ah sound, but that's about the size of it. The large frontal lobes that we have that everybody concentrates on are only the tail that this dog wags, because it's first the development of the sounds, the production of the sounds, that requires the large temporal lobes for storage and processing. And so with this process, we're able to make the complex verbal sounds that we call words, and also store and process them. And God declared all of this to be good. Well, I hope some of you have some comments to fire away at me with.
You use those terms, the geological time scale. Were you using those in similar respect to the present geologists, or were you completely reinterpreting them, what they mean? Time-wise.
No, I use them in the same sense that geologists use them, yeah, today and have been for some time. Yes, sir.
What was your day five? I kind of skipped over that. I didn't get it.
Well, we are somewhat into, to use geological terms, we're somewhat into the at least Oligocene and Pliocene, where all of the modern types of artiodactyls, you know, the hooved animals, they developed all in that particular period of time, all the same families, mostly the same genera, the same with the birds, the same with, by that time, the animals that we are familiar with now had very recognizable representatives. So that when the author says that the living animals were created, he's talking about the animals that are still with us, rather than some extinct fossil forms that we only find in the fossil record at present. Yes, Dan.
Well, why would you restrict that day five to Eocene?
Post Eocene. Well,
it seems to me,
yes, that's true. It mentions whales and so on.
So day five would have to include the Cambrian also.
Well, not the way I view it, because to an ancient Hebrew, Cambrian would be a meaningless. He had no idea of fossil forms. I think by my scheme that each of these glimpses goes along a progressive sequence. We're already at day four, somewhat beyond the Eocene. Day five is taking us up to where the living animals are. So
well,
I think...
Well, certainly, the ancient Hebrew knew about fishes in the sea, and we had fishes in the bone here, so certainly day five would have to
I think our difficulty here is I'm not talking about God actually creating all of the forms at this glimpse. The glimpse that we're given is just of the creatures that's there. It's as though we have a zoom lens coming in to look. Whether or not they were actually, they weren't created at that moment. Certainly, you know, in the late Oligocene, I have a different framework than what you're referring to. Your days of creation, you're thinking of actual creation days. My framework that I stressed at the beginning was one of revelation days, where the author is just given a peek, so to speak, of different stages of the developmental process.
Yeah, is that? I know you put that on the beginning.
Yeah.
You mean if you would call this a revelatory day approach?
Yes, yeah, the whole, this the context, the framework of this approach is a revelatory day. Yeah. Yes, sir.
The viewpoint of the author seems to shift between the second day and the third day, then shifts back again from the third day and the fourth day. Now, that kind of shifting, you know what I mean, he
was observing or being taught, he's telling about things that he could not observe as a person on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
In the first and second day, on the third day, he could observe, so he told him that. And on the fourth day, he couldn't necessarily observe the creation of the sun, moon, and stars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it looks to me like, I wonder what you thought about it, that it would be a lot easier just to assume that things are out of sequence. But the writer actually had revelations that he didn't have in the proper sequence as far as that. But the bigger thing is, it's like it had been obvious to him, even in those days, that he should have known that things don't grow when it's dark.
There is no great necessity to have these glimpses in sequence, in what we consider geological time sequence, but I see no damage done in placing them that way. I don't think for the ancient Hebrew, for almost everybody until 1800 when geology started, a consideration of all the Cambrian and, you know, the whole sequence of living forms, that would have been confusing, bewilderingly, and probably meaningless. Only in the last few years would we derive something of that.
The sequence that they are now, which you started out with, and that is starting with from the viewpoint that the beginning of the creation deals with much greater distance than the immediate Earth, the entire solar system, or the outer fringes of the solar system.
Uh-huh.
You carry that a little further and assume the initial creation starts with the universe, and the third thing could be the beginning of life in this universe, not necessarily the solar system, and the fourth day would begin with the solar system, and then they're all right.
Sure, that's another. Oh yeah, I don't claim that this is the only literal interpretation that's plausible. I'm just spinning out a sort of a one set of coherent interpretations. But I think it is interesting to note that one aspect where Henry Morris and his crew are aliteral in terms of the sun, moon, and stars being in the firmament when they've already, they're kind of stuck with them obviously being way outside the firmament.
Thank you.
Thank you.